Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Clear and direct. That's the sort of communication skills that can make things happen in the workplace. But can there be clear and direct to a fault? And can you work too hard to make the message interesting and entertaining? Joining us now to talk about that and how you can use improvisation, humor, and emotion to improve your workplace communication is corporate communications consultant Rob Biesenbach. Rob also worked as a vice president at Ogilvy Public Relations Worldwide. And before that, he was press secretary to former Ohio Attorney General Lee Fisher. Since 2002, Rob has performed in more than 150 theatrical, commercial, and film projects, learning all the while about something he didn't expect, the relationship between acting and business. Now, he's the author of a book based on those lessons. It's called Act Like You Mean Business, Essential Communication Lessons from Stage and Screen. Rob, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Ann. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. It's been about a year now since the book's been out.
Yeah, it has. Vast year.
So what kind of feedback have you received from this? Are a lot of people saying, oh my gosh, I never thought of that, but you're absolutely right?
Yeah, I think a lot of people seem to feel like this is just makes total intuitive sense that you would apply performance principles to how you communicate. And I'm getting a lot of great feedback, and I'm actually learning a lot. I learned a lot the last time I was on the show from the people who called in who had some great tips of their own.
Well, let's issue that invitation once again to our listeners. If you have some ideas about how to act on the job to improve your work in some way or another, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to the Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So to start off with, Rob, for those who didn't enjoy our last program on this, you say acting and business are not so different. So what makes these two seemingly distinct things so similar?
Well, Jerry Brown, California governor, I use his story to really introduce the subject. He was governor in the 70s, and he's governor again. He twice followed actors into office, first Ronald Reagan and more recently Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he was asked about this phenomenon, probably the only governor in all the states who has twice followed actors into office. And he said, you know, a lot of this is a performance. How do you communicate to 38 million people? It's gesture, symbol, the narrative, the drama. Who's the antagonist? Who's the protagonist? So it's about telling a good story that resonates with people. It's about appealing to emotion. It's about connecting with your audience in a deeper kind of way. So that kind of summarizes what it's all about.
Humor is a quality you discuss as useful in the workplace, but you note that there is a right way and a wrong way to take advantage of it. And you use Mitt Romney as an example. Neither Mitt Romney or Barack Obama have a corner on the market of being necessarily, you know, the greatest communicators at any given time. The following is a clip of Romney and his wife talking with Wolf Blitzer about Romney's love of jokes.
He actually is a very funny guy.
Because you know the image, Governor, very stiff, very proper.
And it's funny how that is. And it's like that may be his public perception, but that is not who he is privately at all.
Is she right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I live for laughter. I mean, but you know, in debates, you get asked questions, you answer the questions. You don't tell jokes. And as a matter of fact, my sons are a little tired of my jokes.
So, Joe, you say that the number one rule for using humor is don't tell jokes.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody who just heard that and just came back to me is reminded of somebody in their extended family who is the joke teller. And there's a big difference between being funny and telling jokes. And usually when somebody comes up to you and says, hey, do you want to hear a joke? You know, the first thing you do is kind of look over their shoulder and think, well, I've got to go across the room and refill my drink. Because it's always so anticlimactic. And it's so unnatural. And that may be Romney's problem. Not getting political, but I think if you try too hard and just say, I'm going to tell a joke now, it rarely lands unless you're a professional comedian. And obviously the better thing to do is to let it happen organically. If you think about the best times that you have with your friends and your family, where everybody's just busting up laughing, it's not because somebody says, hey, you want to hear a joke? It's because of some shared experience, something you have in common. It arises organically in the conversation.
Sometimes when you're public speaking, though, that can be problematic. If you write it down, it loses its magic to a certain extent. How do you mitigate that kind of a problem?
Yeah, again, I think that's trying too hard. And if you're trying to be funny, I took classes, as I said before, at Second City. And the worst kind of classmate was me. No, was the kind of person who says, I'm going to make everybody laugh. And there's a saying that comedy is truth. And if you get to the truth of a matter, that will naturally make people laugh. If you make them go, oh, yeah, I get it. And, I think we brought this up last time. When you're thinking about leading off a presentation and talking to people, don't think so much about a joke, but just think about what happened to you. Everybody has stuff that happens to them in their daily routine, whether they're traveling or just getting up in the morning and getting ready to go out the door. You know, the dog runs away, the coffee maker explodes, whatever it is. And often just sort of relating one of those anecdotes will make people nod their heads, and they'll naturally laugh because they can relate to it. It's something that happens in their everyday lives. And they go, oh, yeah, that. I hate that when that happens.
And as an actor, that's something you're trained to do?
Yeah, you try as an improviser. Mm-hmm. You try to just find the truth of the situation, not always looking for, okay, I'm going to make them laugh now. But you just go with the flow of the situation. You always try to bring it back to something that's truthful and honest. And, you know, to get back at the Mitt Romney thing, he has tried jokes. He did this one where he was in a diner, and he went up to the proprietor and said, I saw the young man over there with Eggs Benedict with hollandaise sauce, and I was going to suggest to you that you serve your eggs in hubcaps because there's no plates like chrome for the hollandaise. Yeah. It's a long silence. That's kind of the way the joke
landed.
Well,
you lost me at hubcap. I was still going back to hubcap.
Hubcap. Yeah, no plates like chrome for the hollandaise. And, you know, actually, my dad used to kind of tell jokes like that. And I always laughed. I was his biggest fan. Mm-hmm. But I laughed because he was my dad. And I think if he was out telling those to a bunch of people, they'd roll their eyes and go, ooh.
Do you think that's the kind of joke someone he actually looked up, or did he make it up, or what's your sense about that, and does it even matter?
Yeah, I don't even know. I had never heard it before, so I should Google it and see if it's in one of those 1001 jokes to put your audiences in stitches books.
it's 101 jokes.
Yeah. It's so obscure. It's probably something that he heard long ago and loves telling.
In our billboard at the top of the hour, we used a cut from the Seinfeld show, the Snapple cut, how he decides to use Snapple instead of just beverage when offering people a drink.
Right.
And it made me think about what you've written about, and I think somewhat recently in one of your blogs, about the idea of being specific and how specificity can be funny and entertaining and that sort of thing. And certainly as a writer, we were taught that as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. Your first instinct is, oh, I should make this as general as possible to appeal to the widest audience. But that's not actually true. It's actually the opposite. Sometimes the more specific you are, the more relatable it is when you have that detail. I think it brings a story to life. It makes people think. It puts them in that situation. So, again, on Seinfeld, what's funnier than being offered a beverage, being offered a Snapple? What's funnier than an heiress, an O. Henry candy bar heiress? What's funnier than Florida, Del Boca Vista? These little details are the ones. It works. It's funnier. And just like you said, in writing, it's the specifics that really grab a reader.
And the Del Boca Vista made me think of another aspect of that is the sound, the cadence of what you're saying. Del Boca Vista, it just sounds funny.
It does.
I can hear Jerry Seinfeld saying Del Boca Vista.
Yeah. I think I saw him on one of his specials sort of talking about this as they would sort of go through and say, okay, what's funny? Clark Bar, that's not very funny. $100,000 bar. Henry. Oh, now that's funny. And that's one of those things where you're watching it as a non-professional comedian and going, really, how do you instinctively know that that's funnier than the other thing? But that's the genius of it. And that's why often you should leave the joke telling to the professionals and just more focus on truth of the matter.
The truth.
Yeah.
Tell the truth. So that kind of flies in the face of the whole idea of acting. Some people think, well, acting, does that mean you're faking it? It's different.
Right. I got that question the other day. I was doing a web seminar. People hate that word, webinar, for a bunch of University of Chicago alumni. There were a bunch of lawyers and engineers on the line, I think. And one of the very first questions was, acting, it sounds phony and artificial. And that was kind of the old school of acting. If you think about the old days of Laurence Olivier stepping to the lip of a stage and delivering a dramatic monologue, very presentational. And the modern view of acting is more like what you see with Robert De Niro, Marlon Brando, or Ryan Gosling is one of my current favorites there.
Hey, girl.
I think he's so amazing. And what they do is they bring some truth out from inside them. They expose who they really are. So a modern actor isn't putting on a mask, but they're finding something in the character that relates to them, and they're bringing up maybe a painful or joyful experience from their own past and using that to sort of make the performance genuine and real.
Yeah, and if anybody wants to know about the Hey Girl reference, just Google Brian Gosling and Hey Girl, and you'll have some laughs, because that's pretty funny. Just going back quickly to the Snapple issue, a lot of people think that kind of stuff is put into shows because it's a product placement. And I think the comedian Stephen Colbert has put that to rest with his forced product placements that he's been doing on his show in recent years.
Right, with the Doritos, Corona beer. Yeah, it's really hilarious. And sometimes I think it might be product placement. I think Friends did a whole episode on Pottery Barn, which I think was very clearly product placement. But, you know, they did it pretty successfully because they made it pretty funny. And again, it was relatable. It was like, you don't shop at Pottery Barn?
And it is a cultural reference that everyone's pretty familiar with.
Yeah, an apothecary table. It's got all these drawers to put, you know, CDs in. People could relate to that. So as long as you make it an organic part of the story and not, you see the less organic ones where the product just happens to be sitting on the kitchen counter and it's just placed just so to show the brand off. And that's a little annoying.
My guest is Rob Biesenbach. He is a corporate communications consultant, actor, and author of a book. It's called Act Like You Mean Business, Essential Communication Lessons from Stage and Screen. If you have an idea for us, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
When you support 89.7 NPR News at the annual level of $85, our gift to you is the WOSU Public Media Member Card. The Member Card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 300 Member Card partners in and around Central Ohio. Save money and support 89.7 NPR News with the WOSU Member Card. Make a gift of $85 or more. Visit us now at WOSU.org/membercard for more information.
Support for 89.7 comes from OSU's John Glenn School of Public Affairs, offering continuing education and graduate degree programs designed for the working professional. More information at glenn.osu.edu.
88 degrees in downtown Columbus. Showers and thunderstorms are likely this afternoon. Some storms could be severe. Expect a high of 96 today with a heat index. It'll feel like 103. Showers and thunderstorms tonight as well, and the possibility of severe storms again tonight, a low of 71. Partly sunny for Friday with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, a high of 88. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Rob Biesenbach. He is a corporate communications consultant, actor, and author. We're talking about his book, Act Like You Mean Business, Essential Communication Lessons from Stage and Screen. If you have a communication lesson for us, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also ask Rob Biesenbach a question or pose a comment to him as well. Rob, I want to talk about... I want to listen to another clip. This next clip, it's a marketing technique from Chrysler. It was a commercial played during the 2012 Super Bowl, narrated by Clint Eastwood. I'm sure a lot of people remember it. Let's listen.
This country can't be knocked out with one punch. We get right back up again, and when we do, the world's going to hear the roar of our engines. Yeah, it's halftime America, and our second half's about to begin.
Rob, you spoke about this commercial, or you said that this actually caused the CEO of Chrysler to cry.
Yeah. Apparently, it was an amazing moment. I read about this, that he was meeting with the dealers of the organization, and he unveiled this commercial. And he surprised them by coming out and to preview the ad. And Chrysler is an organization that has been beaten down. They were at death's door. He said some things. He said, Chrysler, a company that was practically sentenced to death by the press, the financial world, and the public at large. If we were able to do it, there's hope for everyone. There's light at the end of the tunnel. There's always a way to get there. And it just, at the end of the, when he showed the video, people could see he was visibly shaken. He couldn't really say anything. He said nothing more needs to be said, and he walked off the stage. And apparently the dealers jumped up out of their chairs and started applauding, and it lasted for minutes. And it was just – it was incredibly powerful because he was appealing to that emotion. He was appealing to something that connected them to each other, the pride – in the company's heritage and its products. It must have been an amazing moment.
Anthony in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Hey. I can relate to what you guys are saying. Mitt Romney, he is a robot.
Well, I didn't say he was a robot.
Nobody
said that,
he was
Anthony.
A robot.
Well, okay. In my words, he's a robot. They asked him a question. They asked him a question about the economy, and they said, okay, what are you going to do? Fix the economy, and his answer was basically whatever Barack Obama has done, I'm going to do the exact opposite. And that really wasn't an answer. I guess what I was thinking was right after that, I'm rubber and you're glue. Anything you say bounces off me and sticks to you. You know what I mean?
But that's Anthony. That may be true, but Rob, you were in politics for a while, to a certain extent. I mean, Mitt Romney's neck and neck with Barack Obama in a lot of polls, or very close, within striking distance. So something must be working.
Yeah, possibly. It's hard to tell what's going on, and people are also just very disappointed, obviously, with the economic situation. Mm-hmm. So it is a tough environment for any politician.
And there do tend to be those different kinds of politicians, that some like Mitt Romney, some like, let's see, George Bush, George W. Bush, some like George Herbert Walker Bush. They're all different kinds of communicators that make it in politics. Is politics any different from business, in your opinion?
I think it's very different from business, and in some ways similar. You know, what I've found interesting from having worked in government and in corporate life, people talk about how government is so different because it's not like you're a CEO. You tell people what to do and they do it. And it's really funny, if you've ever been inside of a company, you can be the CEO, and people don't necessarily listen to you or do what you tell them to do. There are 1,000 ways to not implement a CEO's vision. And, you could drag your feet, you could deflect, you could tell your people something different, you could object outright. So it's not like a dictator comes in and tells you everything. I don't know if we're getting off track, but I've always found that a really interesting phenomenon.
Well, the role of a CEO, in other words, the role you're playing isn't necessarily what people perceive it to be. A CEO has to be a good communicator, too. Just telling somebody what to do isn't necessarily going to get the job done.
Right. I worked with a CEO who said almost half of his job is communication, whether he's trying to motivate employees, talking to shareholders, talking to dealers about marketing strategy. Communication is critically important. You still have to be, you still have to sell and persuade. So people aren't just going to do what you tell them to do. I was, one of my formative corporate experiences in my early years, right after I left the AG's office, was this employee, a guy, a factory worker on a line, got up and started yelling at the CEO. He called him stupid and incompetent, and you know, you're driving this company into the ground. It was a really weird moment, because that sort of shattered my illusion about the power of a CEO in an organization.
Okay, Anthony, thanks for your call. If you'd like to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tina Fey notes the importance of improv in her book, Bossy Pants. I started rereading that again. Business colleges are starting to offer classes in improv. Do you think the secret power of this tool is finally coming to the surface? So it's what about that idea?
The idea of using improv in business?
Yeah.
Yeah, she talks about it. Coincidentally, I talked about it in my book.
I think
I said it first, but she said it funnier and probably more insightfully, so I have that going for me.
Yes.
But yeah, she said that the first rule of improv is to always agree with your senior partner. You know, whatever scenario your acting partner has set up is one you have to follow. So if somebody says, boy, it sure is hot in here, you don't say, what do you mean? We're in an igloo in the middle of the North Pole. That kind of brings the scene to a standstill. So agreement is an important thing in making a scene go forward. Agreement's also an important thing in keeping things on track in a business environment. And if you're that person at a meeting who's always shooting every idea down and saying, we can't do that, we already tried that, then you're not going to be seen as a very constructive person. So agreement is one of the first rules.
Going back to the idea of tapping into emotion, you mentioned three steps for doing that.
Yeah.
What are those three steps?
A lot of people aren't necessarily comfortable with emotion. I've worked with people who, you know, are just very analytical, and they don't like digging very deep. They're more Spock than Kirk, I suppose. But I think everybody has a reservoir of emotion somewhere deep inside them. And some people it may be very deep, you have to drill down very far, and others it's just below the surface. But if you look at three areas of your life and ask yourself some questions to sort of prime the emotional pump, one would be your work life. That's the first place to start. If you're in business, what do you love about your job? What makes you jump out of bed in the morning? How does your job contribute to the big picture? Are you proud of what you do? What is it about the company's history and heritage that makes you proud to work there? And that's sort of the first place to go. The second one is, if that doesn't really do it for you, you can talk about maybe your outside interests, whether it's golf or tennis or community volunteering. Whatever it is that you do, why do you do it? How is it fulfilling to you? And then finally, if none of that works, if you got a real stiff that you're working with, and I've had, you know,
your share of stiffs
like this.
Yeah.
Ask them about their family. Why is family important to them? One question is, what does your kid think you do? And that's always an interesting, because children hardly ever understand what their parents do unless they're a cop or a firefighter. You know, most people's jobs are much more complicated than that. Or talk about some of the sacrifices you made. Have you had to be away from your family? Have there been occasions you've missed? How does that make you feel? You know, those are ways, if you ask yourself these questions and you can bring yourself to share those, on a stage or with people, then that's a way of really tapping into that emotional reservoir that will help connect people to you.
I remember an experience of being on a jet with somebody for about 19 hours. We were going overseas. She was a big business executive. And for the first couple hours, I thought the only thing I could talk about her with was business.
Mm-hmm.
Until I started to go blind from thinking about electric deregulation. And I thought, my God, how am I going to get through the rest of this plane trip? Finally, I said, you know, you want to talk about something else? And she did. We talked and we still talk.
That was really?
15 years ago. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But I thought all she would care about was the business itself when there's, you know, that was just the tip of the iceberg.
Right. And in the end, we may be business people or whatever we do in our life, but we're also humans, and other humans like to hear about the human experience. You know, people with kids, I think people with kids have a real leg up in the marketplace because everybody obviously can relate to stories about their children. I was just on my way out the door, and my kid threw up all over my shirt. And, you know, all the parents mm-hmm. nod and say, yeah, I've been there. And then they start comparing the color and the consistency, and the single people, like, walk out of the room.
Yeah, they roll their eyes and go, here we go again.
Yeah. Here am I left out. What do I have to do to connect? And, you know, you talk about your dog, your cat, and they tell you it's not the same. So,
well, which brings up the issue of knowing your audience. What do you mean by knowing your audience? That's hard to do sometimes.
Yeah. If it's a one-on-one situation or if it's
like a group.
Yeah. You should do as much research as possible. Sometimes if you're presenting to a group, you have to really know who they really are. And sometimes there's research. Sometimes if it's a group that you don't know, then you can talk to the person who asked you to come speak and ask them about who they are, what's on their mind. Some of the questions that I ask 6 questions, like who are they, what do they want, what do they know about you. But I think the 2 biggest questions that people overlook are what is their mood and what are their doubts and misperceptions. The mood is really key because that's important to setting the tone for how you communicate. So if they're frustrated or angry or impatient or disappointed and you don't have a good read on that, and you're coming in all sunshiny, happy, and everything is great, they'll just write you off as being out of touch. And the other question is, what are their doubts and misperceptions about you? You have to, about you or your organization or whatever you're presenting to them, you have to know what those are and be prepared to address them, whether they bring it up or not. So many companies are reluctant to talk about their mistakes. And they get into big trouble because they try to paper over them, and people see them as out of touch with their audience. And I have some examples of that really, I think, resonate.
Like what?
Okay. I was feeling, am I talking too long?
No. Another question to ask yourself.
I could really do this for about 6 or 7 hours. I don't know how long we're on. Apple. I'll give you an example.
Uh-huh.
Everybody talks about Apple.
Right.
They've had this long winning streak, but they haven't been without their share of mistakes. And one of them was the white iPhone. The white iPhone was supposed to come out, well, almost 2 years now. It's supposed to come out at the same time as the iPhone 4, the black one. And the white one wasn't ready. So they announced it, and they said, okay, we're pushing back the date. And when that date came, the white iPhone still wasn't ready. And so they pushed back the date again, and it still wasn't ready. They couldn't get the formula right for making this white iPhone. And they were widely ridiculed in the press. And even fans were on their case and blogs and message boards. And when the white iPhone at long last was released, almost a year later, Apple put it up on their webpage with a headline that said, finally. So what they did was they addressed the criticism head on. They didn't shirk from it. Mm-hmm. They didn't try to paper over it. They said, okay, customers, we know you're really ticked off and impatient. We understand. We understand we kind of messed up. And they said they admitted that they made a mistake. And then when if you're a customer or an audience member and you see that, you say, oh, okay, they get it. They get me. They understand. And now I can move on and look at this really cool phone and maybe order it. But mm-hmm. if they don't do that, you think, you know, who are these jerks? What are they? They don't even respect me.
What about, like, when there's a big crisis, say the Horizon Deepwater oil leak, you know, in the Gulf? What about how the perpetrators of that responded?
That case specifically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something like that.
You know, there are general crisis rules of thumb that you get out there early. You get out there first. You put your stake in the ground. You have a single spokesperson who people can relate to, a leader, obviously, of the company, a decision maker. And yeah, I think BP obviously had very mixed success. And there's also, you know, the counter school of thought that says you can do all the things right out of the Crisis 101 handbook.
Mm-hmm.
You can apologize to the victims. You can try to make reparations. You can show emotion. But when you're dumping a gajillion gallons of oil into the sea every day, you're going to have an issue, and it's going to be hard to make it go away. Firestone found that with years ago in the late 90s with the crisis where their tires were blowing and Ford pickups were rolling, or SUVs were rolling over on the highway. And there was all kinds of evidence that suggested it had to do with people not inflating their tires properly, or maybe even there was a suggestion that maybe it was the design of the cars and not the tires. You can talk until you're blue in the face, but people's ingrained perception, their perception was already ingrained. And ultimately what Firestone had to do was to really change the brand. They went with their parent brand of Bridgestone, and you don't hear the word Firestone anymore. They just adopted the parent company's name for their products.
Talking about product placement, no more Firestone for you. My guest is Rob Biesenbach. He is a corporate communications consultant. We're talking about his book, Act Like You Mean Business, Essential Communication Lessons from Stage and Screen. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. On the next Fresh Air, Christopher Bea talks about his new novel, What Happened to Sophie Wilder. It's in part about why some people have the capacity for faith and others do not. The character Sophie becomes a devout Catholic.
But that conversion doesn't necessarily lead to peace, doesn't end her struggle, but rather leads to a new struggle.
Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. 88 degrees in downtown Columbus, showers and thunderstorms popping up this afternoon. Some of those storms could be severe, a high of 96. More rain for tonight with a chance of a severe thunderstorm, a low of 71. Partly sunny on Friday and still a chance of rain, a high of 88.
Support for 89.7 comes from Nationwide Insurance Picnic with the Pops, continuing the annual tradition for Buckeye Nation as the Columbus Symphony takes the stage with the OSU Marching Band this Friday and Saturday night at the Columbus Commons. PicnicWithThePops.com.
You can support 89.7 NPR News for as little as $5 a month. As a basic member, you'll receive some great benefits, including a one-year subscription to our program guide, Airfare Magazine, a complimentary one-year subscription to Newsweek Magazine, the WOSU FYI e-newsletter, and a WOSU Public Media Grocery Tote. A basic membership starts at just $60. Visit us at WOSU.org and become a member of 89.7 NPR News today. And All Sides continues right here on 89.7.
My guest is Rob Biesenbach. We're talking about his book, Act Like You Mean Business, Essential Communication Lessons from Stage and Screen. Rob is an actor. He's also a corporate communications consultant. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We have an email from Molly. She writes, I say workers need to act like they want to be working. We can all relate to a BMV, Bureau of Motor Vehicles, or checkout person that clearly wants to be somewhere else. I have to remind myself of this in my own job. Everyone has bad days and reasons to be distracted. It takes effort to actually be where we are, but it helps things go more smoothly for everyone. That's an interesting one.
Yeah, that's great. There's a director, a Second City director. He actually directed back when Tina Fey was on the main stage and Rachel Dratch. He kept this blog of back before blogs were, you know, back before the internet was barely invented. And he talked about rules for actors, and I think they apply to business people. And one of them was, don't come in complaining about how tired you are. Everybody's tired. If you come in and say, oh, I'm exhausted, or I've had a terrible day, or just constantly complaining, that's contagious, and it puts people in that negative frame of mind. And it's one thing to commiserate with your best buddy, but if you're always coming in with this negative aura around you, again, you're going to be seen as somebody to be avoided.
And there are people like that who actually start meetings that way, aren't there?
Yeah, and that's a terrible tone to start a meeting with. And I think sometimes people feel like, oh, everybody can relate to this. Everybody's tired, or everybody's, you know, not feeling well, or everybody wishes it were Friday. But you know, if you turn it around to something positive, I think you're going to set a better tone, a more constructive tone for the meeting.
Let's listen to another clip. This is from the AMC TV series Mad Men, in which advertising executive Don Draper, played by actor John Hamm, is asked by his client to come up with a pitch for a slide projector with a circular rotating tray.
This device isn't a spaceship. It's a time machine. It goes backwards. Forwards. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again. It's not called the wheel. It's called the carousel.
And for those of us who grew up with the carousel,
yeah.
An amazing display of imagery, emotion, everything.
Yeah, I get tingly just listening to it, and it was an amazing moment. Anybody who says, you know, John Hamm was just putting on a mask and faking it there, clearly something from inside him was coming out in order to make that performance authentic. But yeah, he was appealing to emotion. He was using, for people who haven't seen the show, he was using these visuals, the slides of his family, and he had just sort of gone through a major crisis and was thinking again about, you know, where it all takes him back to these early days, his love of his family and his children and his wife after he'd been behaving very badly. And it's just a very poignant moment. And everybody in the room, I think one of the guys, Harry Crane, like walks out of the room and cries because Harry had just done a terrible... They're all these terrible things on this show, and they feel terrible about it afterwards sometimes. But, yeah, he really moved the people in the room with the visuals, with the emotion, with the stories, and with the common touch, something they have in common, love of family or maybe a nostalgia for the past.
Yeah, you suggest this method of engaging is showing but not telling. Again, another tactic that I was taught as a writer, show, don't tell.
Yeah, people tend to... people are very literal. They'll come in an interview and say, "I'm very organized." Well, you know, that doesn't really tell me anything. You say you're organized, but if you say, "I have a spreadsheet to keep track of my spreadsheets," or if you say, "I'm very reliable," again, that's sort of an unverified claim, and it just tells, it doesn't show. But if you say, "I haven't taken a sick day in 7 years," then that's something that's going to stick with people. It's better to give a little evidence in an action statement that shows what you're trying to tell than just telling us.
And it's not necessarily about bragging.
No, it doesn't have to be bragging. If you're in an interview situation, I mean, you should be bragging, or at least not bragging, but showcasing your strengths, right?
Uh-huh. You bring up Madonna and her use of the word "my."
Yeah.
At the Golden Globes.
Yeah.
What? Tell us about that.
Well, it just really struck me. I've always had this thing about the word my. A college roommate of mine was from the South, and he had this very wonderful, proper mother. And she said, you never say, and actually Rick, my roommate, he sort of chastised me at one point because I said, we worked in the newspaper together, and I said, my staff. He said, they're not your staff. You know, he told me what his mother always said. People aren't yours. So when Madonna went on the Golden Globes, she said the word my like six times in 90 seconds. It was my director, my actors, my producer, my video, my... It was just very my. And it just sounded very pretentious and self-centered.
This was pretty recently, right?
Yeah,
because I remember other people were talking about this. This isn't Rob Biesenbach talking. There were other people that were put off by it.
Yeah, you know, I thought, obviously, I thought I was original. Then I went on Twitter, and everybody was saying it. So it is something that resonated with a lot of people. And I think a lot of people already have kind of a built-in maybe skepticism about Madonna anyway. So, but it really did, yeah. My. When I posted on Facebook, I got a lot of people saying, yeah, what is up with that?
Well, you know, Madonna.
Yeah.
It's a copyright or DNA or something like that. Speaking of Twitter, in June you wrote a blog post, Three Things I Hate About Your Tweets, which I thought was pretty funny and interesting because in the world out there when they're teaching us about how to use social media, a lot of these are things that they say they being social media guru type people say we should be doing. So let's go through those. Auto tweets.
Oh yeah, auto tweets. These people who you're not tweeting with an actual person, you're tweeting with a robot. And I understand that you have to schedule things and you can't always be at your desk tweeting, but you should be able to like override it. So like when a major crisis happens, like if everybody's tweeting about what happened in Colorado and your Twitter feed is full of stuff like six tips for better search engine optimization or five ways to impress people, and everybody else's tweets are about that or any big event, it just makes you look, I think it makes you look out of touch. So I can understand the need to automate your tweets, but you have to be careful about that and understand how you'll look sometimes.
And the cross-posting. Cross-posting, I have to say, does bother me.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting it in two places, and it's redundant. And particularly people like me who, you know, I watch my Facebook and my Twitter pretty closely.
Yeah, and this flies in the face of everything you're taught about communications and about performance. Know your audience. Every vehicle, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn, you have a certain audience and there's certain protocols and the ways you communicate. So when my Facebook feed is full of people's Twitter cross posts, full of like five hashtags and all those at symbols, it's annoying. And so I think, well, why am I following them both on Twitter and Facebook if they're just putting the identical stuff across? Now if you have a message that's important to all these audiences, and I do this, then customize it. You only have a few words on Twitter, and you can use hashtags. On Facebook, you might have something more that you can say, more texture and background.
I've never been hung up on hashtags because I'm still working on the 140 characters.
I know, 140 characters. I am not a short-form writer or talker of any kind, so it's a huge challenge. And that's one of my other pet peeves. You see the people... It's funny that you see politicians and business leaders. Rupert Murdoch the other day was using TweetSpeak, like you are for your and abbreviations that you're really not supposed to use too much of on Twitter. It makes you look kind of like an amateur.
Mm-hmm. Although a lot of people still think you are, the contraction is YOUR. It's killing me, but
yeah.
It's true. And then thirdly, you mentioned posting stale news.
Right. I see this all the time on the time horizon in Twitter is so short. On Facebook, you might have a little bit of leeway. But on Twitter, if you're tweeting something like it's breaking news and it happened 2 or 3 hours ago, you look really out of touch because people are posting rest in peace so-and-so, like 5 seconds after the news is released. And if you're just catching on a few hours later, you look a little out of touch. And if it is a few hours old, then you can maybe add a comment about it without making it sound like you're trying to break news, but add a little texture, a viewpoint. And I always hate those rest in peace ones anyway, because somebody dies and it's like people going like, first, I was the first to find out that Sherman Hemsley died. Like, right. Really? Did that make your day?
Is this a goal? Is this a goal? We have an email from Sandra. She says, as an employee of the Ohio BMV, I'm tired of hearing about our bad attitude. I work with great people who care a lot about our customers. I find that many times people don't come prepared to process a certain transaction or request something we are not legally allowed to do. Can your guest offer some suggestions as to how to deliver bad news to our customers? Good question.
Yeah, well, there's whole training sessions on this. how much time do we have? I think explaining the reasons, and let me just say, I've been to lots of private enterprises where the people are completely rude and inefficient, and I've been to plenty of government agencies where the people are warm and wonderful and efficient. So I disagree. The BMV or the DMV is an easy thing to pick on.
And like post office or any of them, you know, it's a stereotype.
Right, right. So I think the most important thing is to be courteous, to try to break the news with a smile, and explain the context or the reasoning. Too often people are just given an answer, but they don't understand why that something has to be a certain way. But if you explain it to them, then they'll maybe have a better appreciation for your answer.
Sometimes people who deal with the same kinds of transactions over and over and over again, wherever they might be, same kinds of problems, same kinds of people who forget to bring something or don't know to bring something, and maybe they've issued this, have had to say it 10 times that day or 100 times that day. To them, they've said it over and over and over again. But to the person you're saying it to, it's the first time they've heard it.
Right. Exactly. Always think about your audience. And that's what we say with messaging all the time. You'll get sick of saying something long before your audience will get sick of hearing it. And especially if you've got new people coming in all the time.
Right.
And it'd be nice if they could get some support. If they're bringing these concerns to the attention of management, maybe there could be some signs up, maybe more better communication on a bigger level.
You know, there are a million signs up in BMV. I just went through there a couple months ago for something, and it cracked me up because still there were signs everywhere about what you needed. Don't go past this point unless you have this, this, and this. And people still got to the end. This was waiting in line for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And people still, it was one of the few places you could go to get a learner's permit, and people still were going all the way to the beginning of the line, finally getting to the end of the line and finding out they don't have what they need.
Yeah, customer service is one of the toughest jobs on the planet, and we see that all the time at the store. You're in a line of seven people, and the person gets up to the front, and they just then decide that they need to find their money, or worse yet, write a check. I was in North Dakota, and I saw two different people writing checks at retail stores. I'm like, wow, I went back in time. What's up with that?
Yeah, it still happens. It's still out there. It's still legal.
Yeah, I know.
You wrote another blog that I thought was kind of interesting. If your company can't communicate, what can it do? All corporate annual reports should come with a disclosure notice on the inside cover detailing the amount of staff hours invested in creating the report and the number of drafts, rounds of approval it went through on its way to completion.
Yeah, it is crazy. I've worked on projects that take far, far too long. If you have an annual report, it should come out, I'd say, within a couple of months of the prior year ending. If it comes out 8 months after that, that's very old news, especially in this world. So I see this all the time. It's the churn cycle in the company, all the different levels of approval. And I think if you can't just handle basic communication, this is my business, but in the end of the day, it's only an annual report. I'd hate to see how you make decisions about truly critical things like worker safety, if this is your approach to a simple thing like a letter from the chairman.
Yeah, you said hours are spent debating issues like the difference between will and shall, or foster and encourage.
Right. And you get the lawyers involved. You know, we can't say that. We can't say this. We need a different word here. In this world, speed is starting to become everything. And that doesn't mean you have to be sloppy, but you're never going to make everything perfect. You're never going to make it completely up to date. When I wrote my book and I talked about social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, in various areas, I think the day we sent it to the printer, Google Plus was announced. So you'll never, and so I didn't get to address that in the book, you're never going to be able to stay completely up to date, especially in something with a long lead time like a print piece. So just get it done, get it out there, and promise to update as new events arise.
You know, I would imagine with the social media the way it is and the way it is changing all the time, it's just morphing all the time, I think, that you would have to do an update of your message, although you do blog and that helps.
Yeah, I'm always finding new things. But what I try to do with the book is try to make it universal enough that, just like when we talked about cross-posting across social media, it goes back to your basic tenets of communication. Think about your audience, think about the vehicle, what's appropriate, and think about, you know, whether you're being overbearing or not. So some things are universal.
You had another one. It's 5 speech-making lessons from Abbott and Costello. And make the connection for me there between the Abbott and Costello and 5 speech-making lessons. What's the connection there?
What did I say about Abbott and Costello?
Well, you said, like Jerry Seinfeld, you grew up watching old Abbott and Costello reruns on TV, and he had deconstructed Jerry Seinfeld in this clip, I guess, had deconstructed the classic Who's On First routine to demonstrate
right.
why it's so funny. But the lessons he draws are just as useful for anyone giving a presentation or speech. Edit to the bone.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I remember. Yeah. So, yeah, they practice this thing over and over and over again. So if you have something important to present, practice it. Make sure you know it. Don't necessarily memorize every word, but internalize the main ideas. Live in the moment. You know, really, really commit. I was in some presentation training the other day, and I could tell when the speakers that we were sort of helping would drift off and lose their train of thought. I asked them, I said, so is there like a voice inside your head telling you, oh, I messed up that word. Oh, what's my next point? Oh, that guy's on his BlackBerry. Oh, what's for lunch? And they go, yeah. So you really got to shut out that external editor and really be in the moment. So if you're talking about a process, picture the steps in your mind. If you're talking about a person, picture them in your head. Really think and feel the words as you're saying them. If you're on autopilot, you'll lose your audience.
They can sense it. And then we talked about this earlier. I brought it up. Heed the music of your words.
Mm-hmm.
You said, why is it easier to remember the words to songs?
Yeah, yeah. Jerry Seinfeld called it musical math. And you do notice that. It's hard to memorize a speech, but most everybody has a song they know by heart. They know all the lyrics, and I think it's because it fits. You know, it rhymes and it has a certain meter. So if you pay attention, there is a certain music in the way one talks. And I guess the best tip I can offer for this is, if you're writing something, try reading it out loud and see how it sounds, and that will help you figure out a good rhythm for it.
Rob Biesenbach, thanks for joining us again today. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Ann.
Rob Biesenbach, author of Act Like You Mean Business, Essential Communication Lessons from Stage and Screen. Thanks to the Allside staff. Not my staff, the Allside staff. Associate producer Amy Jurovich, Allside's intern Corinne Gleckler, Allside's production assistants Rachel Ramey and Leticia Wiggins, and Allside's volunteer Andrew Sweet, video production by Rich and Amber Karsminski. Thanks for listening. This is Allside's with Dan Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7, NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.